From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I have further concluded that the FSB operation to kill Mr. Litvinenko was probably approved by Mr. Patruchev, then head of the FSB, and also by President Putin.
That was Sir Robert Owen discussing a report he delivered to the British Home Secretary this past Tuesday, detailing his investigation into the death of Alexander Litvinenko, a former Russian intelligence officer turned Kremlin critic who died from radiation poisoning in 2006. The report concluded that Litvinenko was killed by Russian security forces and that the killing, quote, was probably approved, close quote, by the former head of Russia's FSB, Nikolai Patrushev, and by President Vladimir Putin. That conclusion was promptly rejected by Moscow. This was Andrei Lugovoy, a member of Russia's parliament and a former security official, speaking with CCTV Thursday.
There was no public inquiry as such. Everything that the British and the media say referring to an open and public hearing is a lie, an outrageous lie, and I can't find any other words to describe it.
Russia's ambassador to the UK, Alexander Yakovenko, called the investigation biased and said it lacked transparency. The Owen report relies heavily on what it calls closed evidence. That is, according to the report itself, evidence, quote, that is relevant to the inquiry, but which has been assessed as being too sensitive to put into the public domain. In other words, secret evidence. The use of such evidence in the UK is part of a recent trend in British law that has upended centuries of its basic principles. Ever since the signing of the Magna Carta nearly 800 years ago, the UK has prided itself on its open legal system. But over the past decade, the transparency of that system has become increasingly clouded, with a growing reliance on secret evidence and closed courts. The changes have even come under scrutiny by the European Union. An article in the Guardian newspaper last April referenced a report by the European Parliament's Civil Liberties, Justice and Home Affairs Committee on the use of secret evidence in legislation and before the courts, which examined the way justice systems across seven EU member states, the UK, France, Germany, Spain, Italy, the Netherlands, and Sweden, use and rely on intelligence information that's kept secret and not disclosed to the defendants or judicial authorities in the name of national security. According to the Guardian report, the UK constitutes an exception in the EU's legal landscape due to the existence of the much-contested closed material procedures, or CMPs, secret court hearings where only the judge and security-cleared special advocates are given access to sensitive intelligence material. By comparison, none of the other seven EU member states have gone as far as the UK in the use of secret evidence in trials. Based on a review of the evidence released in support of Owen's report, its conclusions rely primarily on sworn statements by unnamed experts that were heavily redacted and qualified by statements that the testimony was based upon information and belief. The phrase information and belief qualifies a statement that's made not from first-hand knowledge, but, quote, based on second-hand information that the witness believes is true, closed quote, a phrase often used in legal proceedings to provide a defense against perjury if the witness's statement is later proven false. The 46th annual meeting of the World Economic Forum continued Thursday in Davos, Switzerland, with thousands of delegates from more than 100 countries gathered in the Swiss ski resort to discuss the global economy and politics. At one session Thursday, the question was raised, how to reboot the global economy. That session was hosted by Kevin Delaney, editor-in-chief and co-founder of the online news magazine Quartz, and featured American economist Joseph Stiglitz, the Prime Minister of Ireland, Enda Kenny, Zhang Jin, co-founder and CEO of the largest commercial real estate developer in Beijing, and Nelson Enrique Barbosa Filho, a Brazilian economist and professor of economics, and, since this past December, Brazil's new Minister of Finance. Delaney opened the session with a question.
This question of rebooting global growth is one of the most profound questions of our day. And it ties into many of the other ambitions that are voiced here in Davos this week. Reducing inequality, welcoming migrants, ensuring women can make their just contributions and reap their fair rewards from the economy, and transitioning to a sustainable carbon footprint globally. All of these are much harder to achieve without robust economic growth. And what seemed like a tough challenge a few weeks ago, in the most recent days, might seem even harder. China is officially growing at its lowest rate in years. The IMF, for the third time in the last year, has reduced its global economic forecast for this year. A new PwC survey of CEOs shows that just 27% of them think that growth will improve this year. That number was 35% a year ago. You look at the global markets, investors are spooked. Christine Lagarde of the IMF has described the current state of the global economy as the new mediocre. Some people fear worse than that. So, Mr. Barbosa, I want to ask you, Brazil had an economic contraction last year. The forecast is that the Brazilian economy will contract again this year. Is this the new normal? Periods of contraction, flattening growth, or how do you view this?
No, this is not the new normal. This is a transition phase of Brazil. And the international scenario changed a lot, and we are now in the phase of a new phase that succeeded the boom in commodities, and Brazil is adjusting to this new international scenario. We benefited a lot from the high commodity prices during the last decade, mm-hmm. and most importantly, we used that to finance an increase in our social safety net. That reduced the inequality in Brazil and contributed to a very, very virtuous cycle of reducing poverty, increasing investment, increasing productivity. But in the last 3 to 4 years, the situation changed, both domestically and internationally. And now we are facing the challenge of consolidating the social achievements that we are managed to have in the recent past, and preparing our economy for this new phase, this new environment of the global economy.
So it looks like a tough year for Brazil again with contraction, but you're optimistic in growth beyond that?
Oh, yes. Brazil is still a large economy, the seventh largest economy in the world, 200 million people, and most important, a very diversified economy in terms of products that it supplies. We make plants and we export iron ore. We export oil and export some high-tech products as well. So the question is to prepare our economy for this new phase of the global economy, and that requires some structural change. We are in the middle of that, and we are also an advanced democracy, so these kinds of structural change has to be discussed with all the stakeholders, and this process is underway, and I'm pretty confident that we'll get through this transition phase.
Mishin, I want to turn to you. One of the topics of discussion this week has been China, and China's growth has been slowing. There's a lot of concern, particularly since China represents something like 15% of the global economic output and has spillover effects in other countries. As a private business person, how concerned are you about the economic outlook for China?
I am very concerned, not because I believe that the Chinese economy will collapse, but because we are transitioning from an extremely high growth period of time to a relatively slower growth period of time, when I think the government just announced that we had a 6.9% GDP growth last year. Now, to most other countries, 6.9% is pretty nice. But for China, that was used to growing at 10%, 8%, 6.9 seemed to be a new normal that we called it. But as a private entrepreneur, who we are real estate developers, we're actually seeing two sides of it. You know, on the one hand, you see the media report is very much focused on you know, the stock market is going down, how many percentage, and the local currency seems to be devalued against US dollar. And there's a lot of negative news coming out almost every day. You know, I'm a publicly traded company, so our stock price has gone down like a huge discount to the asset value. But on the other hand, inside China, what we're seeing is of all the new buildings that we're completing last year, this year, we haven't really seen any of the new buildings sitting there not be able to be leased out. The buildings are continuously to be leased out, while the traditional economy are not growing as much. The new ones that I see taking up the new office space are internet companies, mobile companies, technology companies, and that seems to be at least driving Beijing and Shanghai's office space demand.
But you said you had significant level of concern.
I have significant level of concern. This kind of a decoupled reality, you know, the stock market's volatility is a reality, and the media's negativity is also a reality. But on the other hand, the business that we do daily business seems to be matching the 6.9% growth. So that's what I'm. If you just look from the outside, if you just read the media, you think this is a country. If you take out China, the name, you know, you give it to anybody, you think this is a country about to collapse. But not so much the case when we actually work and live in China.
Professor Stiglitz, I want to pull you in. You've echoed Christine Lagarde talking about the new mediocrity. You yourself have written about the new malaise. How do you see the state of the global economy currently, barring really significant government action, which we'll talk about later?
Yeah, I mean, the last phrase is really critical, because I think the austerity in Europe, we have even a small dose of austerity in the United States, that is the major factor contributing to the weak global economy. But the underlying problem with the global economy is lack of aggregate demand, lack of global demand. And there are three, four primary factors contributing to this weak global demand. One of them is another theme that's being talked about a lot in Davos, which is the growing inequality. Those at the top don't spend as much of their income as those at the bottom, who have to spend 100%, sometimes even more. So when you have this growth of inequality, which has been really quite astounding in the last third of a century, you're going to have a weak economy. The second thing is that countries all over the world are going through a structural transformation. And that structural transformation is hard. Markets on their own don't do it very well. Each of the areas of the world have their own structural transformation. Nelson was talking about the challenges facing Brazil. China's going from export-led growth to domestically demand-driven growth. The United States and Europe are going from a manufacturing economy to also a service-based economy. All of this, historically, markets, for reasons I could explain, take a long time, never do this very smoothly. And we're seeing that once again. So that's actually contributing both to the global weakness in demand and to the growing inequality. The third has to do with the transformation in China. China, over the last 15 years, and particularly in the last 7 years, has been the engine of global economic growth. And part of that has been enormous demand for natural resources. Brazil benefited from it. Africa, Latin America benefited from it. It should have been obvious that it was not going to continue, but markets are always short-sighted, and they didn't see the inevitability. And the result is that China had to move from, you might say, the quantity to quality of growth. It was going to be less resource using, and that drives down the price of commodities, and including the price of oil. Now, you might say, why at the beginning, a couple of years ago when the price of oil started going down, people said it was going to be a big boon to the economy. And they were focusing on the users benefiting. Hmm. But if you look at the world system as a whole, one side benefits, the other side loses. So when the oil users benefit, the oil producers lose. Mm-hmm. Now, the question is, what is the nature of the response? And it's very asymmetric when you have very big responses. By that I mean the gainers don't increase their spending, i.e. those who are seeing lower prices, as much as the losers have to contract. And you're seeing that very forcefully in two ways. Saudi Arabia thought it was in very good economic shape, but at the pace of spending that it was engaged in, they had only 6 years of reserves. They had no choice but to cut back dramatically in their spending. Similarly, all that drilling, all that, you know, it was good that they stopped that for the global environment. Yeah. But in terms of aggregate demand, that cutback is again leading to a weak global demand, and that is the primary problem. The private sector is not going to restart it on its own, and it's going to take government.
Ireland's economy last year looked not unlike China's in a way. Your growth in the GDP growth in the third quarter was about 7%, which is a very high growth rate compared to virtually any other country in Europe. So putting the Irish success story aside, what is your outlook for growth in Europe more broadly and in the global economy?
I think I should say, first of all, that politics is about people and their lives, and governments are about making decisions. In this business, you want to be optimistic, despite the challenges that yeah. we all face, whether it be climate change or oil or energy or terrorism or migration. All of these are issues that impact on the general political field. Just 5 years ago, when the government I lead was elected, we were under the hammer of a troika. So we had to make some very difficult decisions. Yeah. Now in a different space, growing rapidly with a long-term economic plan set out to manage that economy in a way that it will not go back to boom and bust days. But I sit around the table at the European Council, obviously in the middle of the recession, in its darkest days, at its deepest point. In Ireland, we held a referendum of the people on the Fiscal Stability Treaty. Now, you might say that generally electorates want to beat down governments if they get a chance in referenda. And yet, in Ireland's case, the result was 60-40 in favour, linking, therefore, our future to the euro, to the eurozone, and to the European Union. So the collective authority of the European Council, representing 500 million people, carries with it enormous potential. Mm. And yet, we find that we've been unable to complete the single market. We've still not broken down the digital barriers internally. We still haven't been able to conclude trade agreements in other places like the TTIP arrangements or whatever. And yet these are things that need to be done by politicians who have got to grasp the concept of leadership and what it can mean for the future. So, you know, the world has changed utterly in the last 10 years and will again in the next 10. And it's to be aware that those frontiers up ahead are changing so rapidly. And that's why, you know, the way that politics was done before, the way that laws are drafted, fall far behind the movement that we find in a modern world. And yet, the problem, I suppose, is that in bigger countries, you've got different forms of government. Around the European table, you've got 28 leaders. And the thing is that you go to meetings after meetings, there's a new prime minister here or a new prime minister there, and it takes a while to bed that down again. And yet we have fundamental principles set out that are for the future, that are about growth, that are about employment, and the best route out of austerity and the best route out of poverty is a job. It's a job that pays, where people have the respect and the dignity and the right to go to work, and that that pays, and that they contribute therefore to their own locality, their own economy, their own country, and as part of the bigger market. So I hope that the situation, for instance, now that Europe will consider at its next meeting dealing with the question of a referendum by the British people as to whether they want to stay in Europe or not, yeah, is a matter of very significant importance in terms of the Union, in terms of its future. And I think that that's an important consideration for leaders to look beyond the next 5-10 years, see where do we want to be? What is the rising generation going to do? Look at the way technology is changing. All of these issues, research, innovation, food security, these are matters that governments have to grapple with. We had an agreement in Paris in respect of climate change, following the Millennium Goals of the United Nations in America. I hope that everybody, ourselves included, measure up to the targets that are set here, because it's about the time beyond our own time. And that's where we need to be. I think the eyes of the world will turn to South America in the next 20 years. I think the eyes of the world will turn to Africa in the next 20 years. Enormous potential. The growing populations, immense size in China, India, Malaysia, Indonesia, in the Far East. So we're only a very small player in all of this as a country with just a few million people. But we've set a model here for how government can actually deal with a very catastrophic economic position, and yet in a relatively short time come through that. The important thing is that you set down the foundations to continue that prospect for the future, so that young people are given a sense of hope, given a sense of inspiration, that they can play a part, follow their career ambitions and have a lifestyle. And it's important, therefore, that we focus on those bigger pictures. But as a small country, we are, if you like, a small model demonstration of how far you can move in a short time. But the challenge is to put in place the process, a longer-term economic strategy, to be able to continue that for those who come behind us.
And that might well include Africa, where, according to the Goodwill Ambassador for the UN Industrial Development Organization, UNIDO, the world is witnessing the beginning of an industrialization movement. That Goodwill Ambassador, Helen Hai of China, said that industrialization has transformed China and other Asian countries and can do the same for Africa. Hai is the CEO of the Made in Africa Initiative and advisor to the governments of Rwanda and Senegal and Ethiopia, where she spent 2 years setting up a factory for one of her country's largest shoemakers. She spoke with Lilin Huang about that experience.
Actually, I did not pick Ethiopia. It was Ethiopia who picked me. The story started in March 2011, when the late Prime Minister Meles of Ethiopia had a meeting with Professor Justin Lin. And then during the meeting, he asked Justin about poverty reduction and economic transformation. Justin advised the late Prime Minister three things. Number one, he said to the Prime Minister, a job creation, it is the key for poverty reduction. Secondly, he said, the fundamental secret for economic transformation for China and Asia for Tigers in the 1980s and the 1960s, because they captured the window of opportunity during industrialization, which enabled them to create millions of jobs, and that is the key for their jumpstart economic transformation. Right now, China is going to relocate millions of jobs out of China in this round of relocation. If Africa can capture this opportunity, they can experience the same economic transformation like Asia for Tigers and China. That is how the story started. The late Prime Minister went to China 6 months later and invited some Chinese company to invest in Ethiopia, and I was being invited. That is the reason I would say I never picked Ethiopia. It was Ethiopia who picked us.
What did you do over there?
It took us 3 months from design to investment to actual production in Ethiopia for export to the U.S. market. In the following 6 months, we doubled the export revenue in Ethiopia in the shoe sector. By the end of year one, I recruited 2,000 local workers. By the end of year two, we recruited 4,000 local workers. After the success of the shoe factory and being asked to become the advisor of Ethiopian government and help them to do the investment promotion, the success does not just stay in Ethiopia. I'm being approached by the president of Rwanda, the president of Senegal. They asked Professor Justin and me to help them for the industrialization. And then last year, we helped Rwanda to create the first export garment factory. It took us 2.5 months to set up the factory, and immediately we created 500 jobs. And the aim by the end of this year is to have at least 2,000 workers in Rwanda. So in Rwanda, it's being a landlocked small country. A lot of people say industrialization is not possible. But in this factory, we're taking cotton from Burundi, we're taking textiles from Uganda, and we are making garments in Rwanda to export to the U.S. So through industrialization, we changed Rwanda from a landlocked country to a land-connect country, and we achieved the job creation and export generation. So I would say, actually, there has been a movement for industrialization in the Africa continent since 2011.
Made in China transformed China. So right now, what do you think is the challenge for Made in Africa to become a reality?
It is a reality already, I think. Back in 2009, few people believed Professor Justin's new structural economics. But now, actually, because of the success of Ethiopia in the industrialization, following the new structural economics, the theory, actually, Ethiopia has become a hot place for the global buyers to relocate their orders. And now Rwanda, Senegal, and more African countries is joining this movement. So I think, actually, this we are at the beginning of the movement, and we are actually seeing success already.
As the Goodwill Ambassador for UNIDO, what have you been doing during the past year?
Actually, I've been invited to a lot of countries to share my experience. Most importantly is the practical experience, because I think a lot of countries, until last year, a lot of them, they all believe, African countries, the leaders, they all believe industrialization is the path, but it's how to find it, how. So actually, by letting them know how to do it, sharing my experience is very important.
Meanwhile, despite progress in promoting gender equality, large gaps persist when it comes to women's economic empowerment. The UN has established a high-level panel to help address these disparities while promoting sustainable and inclusive economic growth. The organization estimates that nearly $30 trillion would be added to the global economy by 2025 if women played an equal role to men in the economy. Deanne Penn filed this report.
The High-Level Panel on Women's Economic Empowerment seeks to mobilize concrete actions to close gender gaps worldwide. It will provide recommendations for implementing the new Sustainable Development Goals, the SDGs, to improve economic outcomes for women. This will include promoting women's leadership in bringing about economic growth that is inclusive and environmentally sustainable. The panel is the first of its kind and was announced by the UN Secretary General on Thursday at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Ban Ki-moon said if the world is to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals, we need a quantum leap in women's economic empowerment. The High-Level Panel on Women's Economic Empowerment will bring together leaders from the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank Group, UN Women, trade unions, and a diverse range of experts on gender, economics, and business. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.